Hello, welcome to Teaching to Meet the Moment from the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching at Stanford University's Graduate School of Education. I'm Mike Hines.
And I'm Nicole Luciani Elliott.
In today's episode, Normal Was Never Good Enough, What's Next for K-12 Schooling, we're going to conclude our first season and ask where we go from here. When we started this podcast 10 weeks ago, we were in the midst of the worst surge in the coronavirus pandemic up to that point. We faced the contested outcome of a bitter and contentious election and a continuing conversation about racism and its insidious effects on our national life, which the pandemic had brought into sharper focus than ever before. As educators, we were struggling with the weight of all of these overlapping crises. We taught through screens at a distance or from behind masks and face shields in person. We reached out to our students by phone, by text, and by app, and we pivoted and pivoted again as policies changed.
We also made space to connect and form community in our classrooms. We put our students' social and emotional needs before their academic performance. We talked honestly about the disproportionate impacts of the pandemic on people of color and those living in poverty. More importantly, we listened to those most affected. We started to experiment with what education might look like if we were freed to pursue our own vision of what was right.
So 10 weeks later, we're still in the midst of the most challenging year our profession has faced. But a new administration and slowly increasing vaccinations have given us some hope. We hear a lot of talk right now about getting back to normal, whether that's this spring or in the fall. But as well-intentioned as that conversation is, there's another that desperately needs to be had.
Normal, in quotes, for so many of us, our students and our families, it was never, and nor is it still, acceptable. So in our last conversation for this first season of Teaching to Meet the Moment, we want to talk about how to stop ourselves and the systems that we work in from simply returning to, quote, normal, and instead force all of us to return to school in ways that build from what we learned, to imagine and reimagine education moving forward in a way that truly, truly serves all our kids. To help us think about this, we've invited our colleague, Dr. Janet Carlson. Janet is an associate professor of research and the faculty director of the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching, or CSET, in the Graduate School of Education at Stanford. Janet began her career in education as a science teacher in rural and small towns. As she moved into developing curriculum, facilitating professional learning, and conducting research, she focused specifically on equity in the science classroom. This started with work related to gender equity and evolved into who teachers thought could learn science, what counted as learning science, and what it really meant to be a good science teacher. Gradually, her equity focus broadened further to students who were being disserved in science education and more generally in the K-12 system. Today, her work at CSET is centered on naming and disrupting entrenched systems of oppression in K-12 education, especially as it's played out in classroom instruction.
Janet, thank you so much for joining us for this last episode of Teaching to Meet the Moment. I think it's going to be a great conversation.
Thanks, Mike and Nicole. I'm really excited to be here. And having listened to the last 9 weeks and being really impressed with everything the teachers and researchers that you talked with had to offer, it's quite an honor to be able to help you wrap up the season.
So I want to jump right in. Last year, you wrote an op-ed for the Hershinger Report about science education in the U.S. And in that editorial, which we're going to throw up into the chat right now so people can take a look later. You said in part that normal science education has been systematically eliminating many people from pursuing STEM careers and that it's led to a society that struggles to use science in its daily decision making. You went on to say that we must accept that the pre-pandemic normal was never good enough. As we look towards a world in which there is a vaccine for COVID-19, we need to leverage the disruption that the pandemic has brought to education. We must reconsider how to allocate time and what content we privilege in our K-5 schools. So as a way of getting into this broader issue of why a return to normalcy is not good enough, I wonder if you could explain that article a little bit. What did you find was wrong with science education in the U.S. before the pandemic? What did the pandemic expose, right? And how do we go about changing it?
Big questions. So some of what I think is troubling about science ed is pervasive in K-12. I just happen to do my deeper work in science education. A little bit of what's troubling in science ed is more specific to science and I would argue most STEM courses. Mm-hmm. And there's a way of teaching and what counts as learning that privileges white ways of knowing, white ways of being, and particularly middle and upper class ways of being in the Western world. And when you put all those adjectives together, you start eliminating the path to understanding science and becoming scientific literate from lots of people's lives. And if you look at how our country responded to the pandemic, that's just one gigantic example in front of us right now of how we weren't able to engage in scientifically literate conversations about our choices in how we lived and functioned beginning, middle, and what we hope is now the end of the pandemic. And that plays out in both who feels like they have access to that conversation, mm-hmm. Whose voices we listen to, how we look at data. It was multiple months into the pandemic before anybody disaggregated the data and realized that brown and black people in this country were being disproportionately affected in serious and life-taking ways from the coronavirus.
It's similar to what I feel taught us about history education at this time. It just feels like any kind of crisis puts a magnifying glass on what we do well and what we don't do well. Mm-hmm. And if I learned anything from the last administration in this country, it's that history education matters. And we have spent a long time not paying a lot of attention to it. And we're seeing that come up in so many ways. And it reminds me a little bit of science when people will say, well, that was your opinion. No, actually, it happened. So I'm wondering if there's similarities. Mike, do you see that? I mean, you're an historian, so you know certainly better than any of us.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's certainly a lot of parallels to be drawn. I think that this pandemic was, you know, it was a public health failure, but it was also a public policy failure at the same time. And I think, you know, the distrust of science that we saw early on in the pandemic is really related to and a part of this larger distrust for expertise, right? This larger inability to separate fact from fiction, right? To think critically, to be able to be media literate, right? When discerning sort of what's out there that's fake and what's not, what's factual. And so I think those are issues that we all tackle in civics, in social studies, in history classrooms. But those are also related to, right, this science conversation as well in a lot of ways. And then, of course, I think that, you know, the disproportionate impacts of the pandemic on communities of color, that has been, you know, something that's been felt across the board. So, Janet, I'm wondering if we could go back to the classroom and if you could talk a little bit more about how you're seeing science education be really cut off, right, for some of our students, right? How are you seeing these roadblocks being put up to science education and science knowledge?
In the particular op-ed that you referenced, we were focused on elementary science in particular, although many of my points would apply K-12. And one of the things that is true in elementary schools is science doesn't get very many minutes. If you disaggregate that data and you look at schools that serve lower income communities, you will see science almost eliminated from a time point of view. That doesn't even count. Do they have materials to do science? Do they have any materials that you can read scientific content in a language that's familiar to the students and their families? Is it even timely? Like, is the book less than 10 years old? I'm probably more concerned about materials than books, because reading about science is really not the same as doing science. There is also a narrative about who gets to do science, and you need to be well behaved in order to qualify as someone who gets to do science. And there is, of course, a growing body of evidence that's showing us what counts as being behaved and how that's got a racial component to, as well as an economic component. So if you start putting all these pieces together, all of a sudden you've got large groups of students in this country that do not get time to explore science phenomena, time to use evidence to develop explanations, time for their voices and their ways of seeing the natural world to be articulated and count. And that means now science and other STEM-related areas don't exist in their world, and they're taught by what we don't do that that's a white path forward. That's a middle class or upper class path forward. And that creates a systemic injustice. It starts in our schools, but extends beyond that, and then defines who has those majors in college, who has those jobs after college, who's making the policy decisions that affect us all.
I mean, that's exactly where it comes back to this pandemic and to the disproportionate impacts of the pandemic on people of color, right? Mm-hmm. To have somebody who's in a position to say, hey, we need to disaggregate the data by race, right? You have to have those voices in the room, right?
Yes.
And getting those voices into the room means you have to build that pipeline, right? Starting in the K-12 schools. So many great points that you just made. I'd want to highlight one, which is that, you know, where we put our resources, right, is a sign of where our priorities are. And one of our most valuable resources in schools is time, right? What do we spend our time on? What do our students spend time on doing? For so long, and I think you identified this in your op-ed, right? For so long, we've been pretty much myopically concentrating on reading and math, right? Because those are the tested subjects, right? Those are the subjects that determine, because they're tested, what sort of funding your school is going to get, whether teachers keep their job, whether your school is going to be closed and restructured, right? And so we continue to sort of focus in on those. But we narrow the curriculum to the point where we leave things like science, things like civics, history, things like art, you know, not to mention art and gym and music and theater, right? But we're leaving so much, under-resourced in terms of the amount of time that we give to it during the school day.
Yeah, I had that same conversation in my head, Janet, as you were talking about science. And it just speaks to our colleague Sharon and I have often talked about, we really should be thinking about science and history together, because there's so much overlap just in the ideas of inquiry and things like that, but also in how they're completely left behind in elementary education. History and science, I think in some of the schools we work at in San Francisco, maybe get 20 minutes a week. And they have to split that 20 minutes, right? Yeah. And both can be taught, like both can be used for teaching reading, for teaching math.
Yes.
And that, I think, speaks to the importance of our work in instruction and to help folks think outside of what's quote normal, and to think really longer term. Because Mike, in addition to your point about, who's disaggregating the data and who's demanding the data on folks, we see the same thing with, and you know this again better than any of us, who's doing the scholarship in history and how does that impact policy as a result? you know, we were speaking, we have this institute, this partnership with Stanford Global Studies. And this weekend, we just had an institute on citizenship and identity. And one of the professors we had from UCLA was talking about, she was trained to study citizenship through things like, you know, just quantitative data, not looking at the human impact. And it wasn't until she said, no, we're going to study this human impact. And then she's slowly starting to change the field and the scholarship. And I think in the social sciences, we're starting to see, or maybe we're just starting to be aware of, and maybe by we, I'm meaning white America, is starting to be more aware of just what the systemic impacts are of what we're doing with our kids. We've talked about a little bit around the office about our colleague, Linda Darling-Hammond, who used to be a professor at Stanford. She's now at the Learning Policy Institute. She recently wrote a piece, and I'm going to quote here, "Those of us who work in education must acknowledge that our school systems have been complicit in perpetuating systemic racism. This has included the criminalization and marginalization of Black children by policies and practices ranging from discriminatory discipline to inequitable school funding and staffing to curriculum tracking and school segregation. Our goal in this moment must be to dismantle these discriminatory policies and replace them with approaches that honor the dignity of the lives of our Black children as they do all children." And so with that in mind, I ask the both of you, I'm wondering, how do you see this as critical to your work with educators? Mike, with your work with Stanford undergrads, as well as potential educators in your work with Stanford Teaching Education Program, what is your role and what is our role collectively in thinking about how to use this moment to shift and finally get some work done?
It's a huge question. It's a huge problem. I think I can speak to, you know, my own little like sliver of this problem or where I see myself making, an intervention or at least trying to make an intervention, right? I think it's my job as a historian, right, to help give students access to what we call in history, right, the long conversation, right? This sense of context, this sense of continuity, the sense of cause and effect historically, is what I mean by that long conversation, right? And some voices have been systematically silenced or marginalized or excluded from that conversation. And so where that happens, it's my job to bring those voices back into that dialogue and into that discourse, right? And that means for me, a lot of times bringing it back to this long tradition of Black theorizing, around education, right? And I think that, you know, if we look at the courses at most, I would say the vast majority, of schools of education in this country, Black voices are not being lifted up. Black voices are not being centered, right? Even when we're talking about educating more and more Black and Brown students, right? And so it positions Black people as people who are acted on instead of acting, right? And it gives us a real poverty of resources, a real poverty of paradigms and frameworks that we can use to deal with these inequities that we have in education, right? So why wouldn't we be drawing from this sort of deep wellspring of Black thinking and Black theorizing around education, right? So I think that's sort of where I see myself called to do work in schools of education particularly, right? I'm very, very tired of going into curriculum studies courses and education policy courses and philosophy of education courses and seeing few, if any, Black scholars mentioned. Right. When we know that there's this long tradition, we know that there are Anna Julia Coopers and there are Nannie Helen Burroughses and there are Carter G. Woodsons. And, you know, there are these lines, W.E.B. Du Bois, and these lines of scholarship and lines of thought and not, you know, not just one line of thought, but heterogeneous ways of approaching education from different Black perspectives, right? So pointing that out and bringing that into the conversation is really what I try to do.
Janet, what do you think?
I'm trying to think about how to capture the work that I do with early doctoral students. I teach a required course on teaching and learning that people from all programs take, whether they want to or not. And I always look at my challenge to be, how can I make you care about teaching and learning? Mm-hmm. Some people will play out that teaching and learning in positions in higher ed. Others will be teacher educators or future teachers. Some will do research in K-12 settings. And some of the things that I've been trying to shift to be more responsive to our times and less subtle is to name some of the work that particularly white people need to do. And I name myself in that when I'm teaching. Everybody needs to do their own work to understand where they are situated with regard to their contribution, whether implicit or explicit, to the injustices that are perpetuated, and who we are and who we understand ourselves to be from a gender perspective, from a racial perspective, from an economic perspective, all influence the ways in which we interact in the system, that the educational system in particular. An interesting experience that I've had in the last year is articulating to other white students the role of affinity groups and how our job is to not be in the people of color affinity groups. Our job is to become allies, and that puts work on us instead of expecting our colleagues of color to always be teaching us about the ways of the world we don't yet see. And I think that feeling of being excluded challenges white people sometimes. And I would argue it's because we were rarely excluded. We held the power, we held the position. And to realize that and process that from the position of an ally and being supportive of affinity groups is one of the explicit things I've taken up in my teaching. And I think I'll pause there, Nicole. I'd like to see what you have to say.
Yeah, I think what I appreciate what you're naming is there's two levels that we all need to enter into this conversation. One is personal, and really, what do we need to do as an individual human? I have said from almost my first day of teaching, and I will continue to say 28 years later, I think it is now, teaching is a spiritual act in that our students hold up mirrors to each and every one of us to show us all the things that we need to learn. And we're either willing to learn those things in service to them and in service to our system and in service to our world, or we're not. And so I think one thing that I'm constantly doing, especially when I bump up against students or teachers, even my own children for that matter, when I feel deeply frustrated, I have to step back and say, okay, in my worldview, this is a spiritual teacher for me. And what do I need to be learning? As opposed to getting defensive, right? Really thinking about how to not personalize this and how to see this as an opportunity to learn how to be a better service in my work. The second layer for me comes in, what do we do? What lights us up? You know, I was raised Italian Catholic, and the saints were always in the conversation, and Saint Catherine talked about, you know, do what the thing that sets your heart on fire. And a writer I write talks about, you know, follow the thing that breaks your heart. And that's the thing you should be really paying attention to. And I offer that because I think so at schools, we're so busy trying to do everything that we just can't. And the reason that we all come together in this place we call school is that each and every one of us is a puzzle piece that comes together to create the whole. And I can't be worried about Mike's puzzle piece and Janet's and Christine's and Javier's. I got to worry about my puzzle piece. And really, that puzzle piece is what breaks my heart. And what am I going to do in service to that thing to make it better? And so if we're all doing that one thing, And then we come together in community to really think about how to do those individual things in service to our kids. That to me is where the magic happens. And so when we're having this conversation about let's not go back to normal, like I crave routine, I crave structure, I crave three-dimensional human beings, but I don't crave the normal that is predicting who is going to succeed and fail in school when they walk in the door. I don't crave the normalcy that says it's okay if some kids don't make it. No, it's not okay, right? And how? What are we going to do? Otherwise, what was this whole year for if we don't figure out what breaks our heart and how we're going to go about fixing that? So I just think about it on those three levels, like me personally as a human being, what's the thing that lights me on fire that is my place? That doesn't mean I don't care about the other things, but that means I'm really going to focus on that. And then third, how do I come in community with my people to really think about how we put our pieces together?
I want to underscore something that you embedded in what you just said, because I think it's really important with this theme of not returning to normal. Mm-hmm. Not returning to normal means not accepting a system that doesn't let everybody succeed. It doesn't mean we don't reestablish routines and create that those structures that for human beings are part of our well-being. And the fact that you made that distinction is really important. Too often, all those parts and pieces are conflated, and that's what lets us perpetuate this inequitable system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I definitely agree. I think one of the other things that I want to highlight and point out and maybe use to pivot from is, Nicole, you talked a lot about coming together as community, right? And being able to learn and build from the experiences of others, right? And one of the things I've enjoyed over the last 10 weeks has been working with CSET, right? With you, with Javier, with Christine, because it's been this opportunity to more explicitly focus on practitioners, right? And practitioner facing work in a way that we rarely do, even in schools of education, right? And you guys have these conversations all the time, and I'm so jealous. And you have this vantage point. You have this vantage point that I think few of us have, right? In seeing not only the problems in education, but you get to talk to the people who are on the ground, consistently making these creative, courageous solutions, right? Whether those people are educators or whether they're activists or parents or students or other policymakers. So I want to know from you, Nicole, and from Janet as well, with your sort of vantage point, as, you know, directing CSET, what are some of the bright spots? What are some of the promising trends in education that have emerged from this moment, right? We've had 10 weeks of guests who've told us not only what's going wrong, but also have pointed out to so many things that that should be models for where we go in the future, right? Mm-hmm. So where do we find those promising trends and what's really come out of this moment?
We talked at the very beginning in our planning for this podcast about this idea of surprise affordances. Like what have been things that I think we can all say that this has been the hardest year of teaching we've ever had. Even teachers who are well seasoned and extraordinary will say they feel like first year teachers again. And when I think about what's going right that we can draw on and draw from, I think about how to look at this time with a different lens. Like, I'm going to take off my glasses, the struggle bus glasses is what I call when I talk to teachers, you know, when we're just struggling. Let's take off the struggle bus glasses. Let's put on the glasses of what we can learn here. What has this taught us? It's taught us about our resilience. It's taught us about our courage. It's taught us about the importance of following curiosity. Like if I've heard one teacher say, heard 50 teachers say, I wonder what would happen if. And then they try something that they would have never tried before. All these really cool opportunities for thinking differently. I think that the pandemic has forced us to learn how to use technology more efficiently. particularly around racial justice and how we are or aren't serving our kids. You know, when Mr. Floyd was murdered and then Ms. Taylor was murdered, I felt a tipping point. And I started to feel it tip when we lost Philando Castile in, I think, 2016, because he was one of us, right? He worked in the cafeteria with our kids, and he was one of us. And it started to tip. I started to feel a shift. And then when we lost those two other folks, when they were taken from us last summer, all of a sudden now we're having conversations that maybe we wouldn't have before. And so I think the overlay of the pandemic and, you know, the political pandemic, arguably the racial pandemic that's been going on forever, that the folks are just now coming to the table to discuss. I think the kind of trifecta of those three things, they're pushing us to do things that we wouldn't have done before because we could have gotten away with not doing it before. And that's no longer the option. My deepest fear is that we will go back to school and we will lose that sense of urgency.
Mm-hmm. I'll share your fear, Nicole. I think it's really important that we don't get complacent. And remember, we're really in a triple pandemic. Mm-hmm. It's racial, it's economic, and it's COVID. But Mike, going back to your point, what are some of the bright spots and promising trends? Because it isn't all doom and gloom. I've been encouraged, and we heard some of this in previous episodes, that people are challenging grades and the role of grades and starting to say out loud, maybe there's very little relationship between grades and learning. Research actually has shown that for decades, but it's a piece of the school system that we have not challenged. And to see universities like Stanford go to credit, no credit options, to see schools starting to say, we're not going to grade, to see applications for graduate school and going to college say, you don't need to do the SAT or the GRE. And I realize I'm conflating big test scores and grades, but they all have the same artificial purpose of separating people and pretending they're important. So that's a potential bright spot, especially if we hang on to some of those trends. I think that there's been not just an awareness, but a willingness to creatively solve problems like the digital divide. We've known for many years there are families trying to do all of their digital work on one device, usually a phone or a tablet of some sort. And you look at some of the efforts that were community-based with companies supporting the purchase of devices and school districts figuring out ways to get them distributed. We still have not fixed the digital divide, but again, promising trend. Similar things happened with getting food to families. They stopped saying, oh, families must come to us. And St. Paul School District, for example, put the food on the bus route and went to where the families are. And that's not the only example. It's just one I can name specifically. The use of devices is changing. And Nicole talked about affordances. There are teachers telling me about student participation because of chat in Zoom or whichever platform people are using. The kids now have a voice. And when teachers began to realize that, I heard them talk about, oh my gosh, let me leverage that. And so can we take some of those things forward with us in our hopefully post-isolation approach to life? The piece that continues to discourage me is the political divisions that exist in our country and how decisions that should be made on data are being made along political lines. And so that's a discouraging trend. And Mike, I'm wondering if I could just use that to transition into the next question, but I don't want to cut you off from offering a bright spot.
Yeah, I would think, really quickly, bright spots for me have been mostly around our willingness. And this goes for us at the college level, but down to the K-12 level as well. The willingness that I've seen from colleagues and the willingness that I've seen from teachers and administrators that I know, to put students' mental health and social and emotional health first, right? The willingness, and it was a change in mind frame for many of us, right? But the willingness to go above and beyond, to keep that sense of community, with your students, to check in, to do whatever it takes, to email, to call, to text, to, set up a Jamboard, to set up a Google Drive or a Google Doc, to get in your car, right? I have a colleague who's an amazing principal, in the DC area. And he's been doing drive-by events since last summer, right? Just so that students can see him, so that students can get to have that feeling of community still, right? So I think the bright spot for me has been, seeing our willingness to put students' social and emotional needs first. That also dovetails with what you were talking about grading practices, right? Valuing their social and emotional health has also led us to, not devalue their academic performance, but to think differently about their academic performance and to prioritize things differently. And I think it's demanded a real shift from a lot of us, as teachers. That's my bright spot.
Even going back, Janet, to what you said earlier about what counts as science, right? Learning and what counts as good science teaching. Kind of build on what Mike was talking about, what counts as learning and what counts as a good student? You know, when we think about the cultural behaviors that are made assets in school versus the cultural behaviors that are made liabilities in school, I think the pandemic has forced us to recognize that there are a lot of things that maybe school made a liability that is actually quite extraordinary. And what a gift that this child comes with this skill. And maybe we should think beyond counting whether they titled their paper correctly as points and maybe think about something different. So I am hoping this will carry forward.
I particularly think it is crucial that we pay attention to the social and emotional health of our students as we return to the structures we recognize as normal. We're not going to suddenly turn a switch and all be mentally and emotionally healthy. That's not going to happen to the students, not going to happen to the families. It is going to be a process. And that process includes families getting back to work, families facing eviction if rent relief is not available. I mean, there is plenty of stress ahead. And so we can't forget when a higher percentage of people are back in buildings that all that stuff is still going on. And we need to continue to put that social and emotional health forward if we want kids to learn. For our last set of conversations, I want to reference a really lovely article by Hugh Vasquez at the National Equity Project, and we'll post this in the chat as well. In this article, he talks about the need and willingness to be disturbed as a first step in changing broken systems. And I think this has a very close relationship to what Nicole and her buddy St. Catherine have to say about what sets your heart on fire. Okay. And typically our hearts are set on fire by things that bother us. And so that's in that space of willingness to be disturbed. So as we have to see and sit with the extent to which our reality undervalues and under-resources kids and communities, that locating that which sets your heart on fire and that which you are willing to be disturbed by becomes really important. That said, it's also difficult, it's uncomfortable, it's uneasy work. And so at this moment, where many of us just want that stability that Nicole was referencing, how do we convince ourselves, our colleagues, our family members, our friends, that really it's time to stay disturbed and work toward lasting structural changes?
I think that's the big question, right? That's the huge question as we, hopefully start to move out of this, present moment of just panic and crisis, right? And I think that, you know, being realistic, and being historical and using a historical lens, we do not have a great track record, right? Of making the most out of these moments, right? For change. We don't have a great track record of, really pushing the envelope and making the kinds of changes that we need to change, right? We have, all too often let things just sort of slide back into what's comfortable or slide back into what's normal. And so I think that's the real challenge moving forward. I think I take heart in, so many of the guests that we've had throughout the season. So many of the organizations, I'm thinking, you know, right now, just off the top of my head, I'm still thinking about one of our early conversations, with Dr. Misha Mosley and, of the Oakland Black Teacher Project. You know, I'm thinking of some of the organizations and some of the people that we've talked to, that have really like laid out a path forward for us, right? And those are the same people that have been doing the work before this moment started, right? So I think that one encouraging thing and one thing that I would encourage people to do is to keep looking for the people who've been doing the work, right? And connect with those people, right? And build community with those people, because it's going to be impossible to keep that momentum going if we're doing it by ourselves, right? But there are groups, there are communities that are out there doing the work.
Yeah, and I think one of those, two of those, three of those organizations have been referenced here over the course of our time together. One that we haven't talked about is a new organization led by one of our Hollyhock fellows, Maria, who has started a project called the Thriving Teacher Project. And her intention with that project and with that program is to provide a space for teachers to really thrive. And for me, when I think about how do we stay uncomfortable to keep the work going forward, we have to make space for our teachers to heal. They have been the social safety net because of what's happened to our safety net in this country since it was built post New Deal, even post World War II. It has been dismantled to the point where our schools become the safety net. And when those schools were gone because of the pandemic, what happened? Well, what happened was our teachers stepped in and continued to keep the bus moving. And that comes at a cost, you know, the secondary trauma of serving kids who are in trauma is enough. And now we have our own trauma on top of that. Our teachers are parents. Our teachers are married to health personnel. Our teachers have lost family members to COVID. We've lost teachers to COVID. And for me, in order to stay uncomfortable, we have to heal. Because if we're not healed, then we stay in this kind of survival mode, and we can't move forward if our teachers are in survival mode. And so I think this next year for me is really thinking about how do I contribute to the well-being of my teachers, our teachers, so that this whole year that they've been holding our safety net together, they can feel us holding them together as we move back into schools. And I think if our teachers feel held, and that might allow them to feel brave to continue to tackle these systems that they know exist. Our teachers are not dumb. They know what's happening in their schools. And part of the reason they're broken is because they're continually being asked to maintain the system that leave kids behind. How can I, in good humanness that I exist in, say it's okay for these poor kids to be left behind? And yet that's what we ask our teachers to do. So for me, it's really about how can we heal? And then how can we stay angry, right? We need that rage. We talk about outrageous love. That's something, our term we learned from Dr. Shrafti Holly. Rage is a part of outrageous love. If you don't have rage, you don't have fuel. So we have to keep that fire stoked. but we just have to do it in a way that it doesn't burn our teachers out in the process.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Nicole. I think just like our frontline health workers, teachers are some of the unsung heroes for this last 12 months while we've been grappling with remote learning and hybrid learning and am I going back or am I not going back challenges. And the one of the biggest mistakes any of us that work in education could make is to act like it hasn't had an impact on teachers and to treat them anything less than the professionals they are while remembering they're human beings. They're whole human beings. Mm-hmm. And they've had to deal with immeasurable challenges this year while holding their students.
I agree. I think something that was said by one of our panelists last time was that he looks for moments that refill his bucket, right? And I think it's important that we, you know, create those moments for each other, right? That we look for those moments, that we seek those moments out, especially in, you know, the months to come, right? And, you know, to that point, I think that this entire project, this entire podcast, has hopefully been one of those bucket filling moments, right? For our listeners. I know it has been for me. I know, I think it has been for Nicole as well. And for everyone at CSET as well. So we're trying to create those moments in our own way here, to keep our own buckets full.
Indeed. Indeed.
And perhaps one of our parting challenges to ourselves and everyone listening is what can you do to add to someone else's bucket? Mm-hmm. Particularly at teachers.
Mm-hmm. Great. That's great. So in bringing us to a close, usually this is the point in the podcast where Mike and I talk about the things that we are taking away from our guests. This time, though, the whole episode was kind of takeaways about teaching to meet the moment, both the podcast and the work that we're all doing in this unique context of time and place. It's also our last episode of the season, so we're going to just take a couple of minutes instead to share some gratitude, and we thank you in advance for sticking with us because we've had some extraordinary people we want to thank. First, we want to thank our guests, a diverse and glorious group of humans who go above and beyond every day in service to our kids. Our guests offered us perspective, ideas, some laughs, a kind of nourishment that we all really needed so badly. And Mike and I will never be able to properly thank them for their time and their service to this community. We also want to extend a thank you to Javier and Christine, who you all see in the chat, but have never really seen in human life, probably. They serve as the backbone of this whole endeavor, guiding our ship so Mike and I can be free to engage in these conversations without worry about what's happening behind the scenes. So an extraordinary thank you to Javier and Christine on behalf of all of us. To Janet, our guest, CSET's faculty director, and our colleague Suzanne Burrows, who's the CSET's executive director, they signed off on this crazy idea, even though we had no experience and no funding. And I've said before, and I'll say it forever, empowering leadership that celebrates vulnerability and thoughtful risk-taking is the very foundation of innovation. And Janet and Suzanne have created this culture at CSET where we're really allowed to follow our curiosity. And Mike and I, along with Javier and Christine, really just were able to do that with this podcast, and we're so grateful. A personal thank you on my behalf to my podcast partner, Dr. Michael Hines. He was my very first ask to be a co-host on this show, and he said yes to the dream with no details, no pay, and no promises other than we would stay focused on our goal of serving teachers. And he brought an extraordinary wisdom to this work, and I know for sure we're all better for him being here. And finally, a thank you to our listeners, educators of all kinds around the country who trust us with your very precious time. We thank you for that time, for your attention, and above all, for your love and effort in service to our kids. So that's it, friends. Big love to you and yours, and we look forward to seeing you all next time. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.